So the movie portrayed this in a very tepid sort of way. You know, they actually downplayed it, which, you know, isn't what you'd expect Hollywood to do. You'd think that they would exaggerate any time they had a chance to put on a light show or show some pyrotechnics. But instead, they just have this little light shine on the actor and hold him for a minute and toss him back. But it wasn't like that. It was just this blast that happened all at once and just threw me back through the air. You know, I said 10 feet. Steve, you know, he's in the lower right there. He insisted that it was more like 20 feet. And he was probably in the best position of anybody in back in the truck, because he was sitting near the on the door side towards the thing, and he never took his eyes off of it. So there's a mic in the upper left. He was driving the truck. Ken Peterson, he was in the middle in the front. And then me, we're sitting by the door. And then Alan was in the back along with Dwayne Smith in the lower left there. He was 6'7" or something like that, a really tall guy. And then the guy in the middle there is John Gallette, and then Steve Pierce in the lower right. He was played by Henry Thomas in the movie, who you might have noticed was actually the little boy in the movie E.T., all grown up. But Mike was the crew boss, was played by Robert Patrick, who was the liquid metal man in Terminator. But Alan Dallas was played by Craig Sheffer, who I think did a really good job. You know, a lot of ad-libbing in what he did there. Anyway, me back then. And the truck that we were driving. And that's what we saw, you know. And this is kind of from my perspective, looking up at it right before I was hit. And I just, you know, was at first just standing there just in awe of this, you know. And John Gallette describes this as looking like some powerful sports car, you know, just really, just real impressive and actually beautiful in a scary kind of way. But when that beam hit me, they thought it killed me. Immediately they started yelling, it killed him, it got him, you know. When Steve Pierce said it got him, he means got him like he got a deer, you know. He's dead. And that's what their thinking was. And that's why they were screaming to the driver, get us out of here. And a lot of people hearing all that said, oh, yeah, a bunch of real heroes there, you know, and basically insinuating that these guys were cowardly to take off at that point. But, you know, they saw what they thought killed me. You know, they thought they just saw somebody get killed. And they described to me how they drove down the road like crazy, you know, crashing into trees and nearly wrecking the truck to get away from there. And then they stopped and started screaming about what happened. And Steve says that Dwayne Smith said he disintegrated. It knocked him to pieces, you know. And Steve told him, no, I kept my eyes on him, and I saw him hit the ground in one piece. So that increased the odd idea that, you know, maybe if they did return, maybe I was just hurt, that they were, you know, that it was worth trying to stage a rescue. And so I got to give these guys credit. They did go back. They thought they'd just seen somebody get killed. They thought they might be next. They had no weapons. And yet they had the courage to go back to try to see if they could rescue me. So I find no fault with what those guys did. And a lot of people think, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. I'd be out there where Travis was. But, you know, I shouldn't have been doing what I did. That was a mistake. But when they approached the site coming back, they saw it lift up. and streak off towards the northeast. That helped, you know, restore a little confidence about, you know, and the closer they got to where it was, there was a little bit of searching to make sure they found the spot. But when they'd taken off, you know, the tires on the truck had really spun and dug out. So they knew that spot. And then when they stopped, they could see my tracks going up into the clearing there. But for a minute there, they were too scared to get out. They only had one flashlight. So they said they were, you know, all just huddled real close around this one flashlight, you know, just shoulder to shoulder. Steve says he was doing his best to stay in the middle of the group, you know. But, you know, here these, you know, big tough loggers are all huddled around the light. But, you know, I don't blame them. They, as they moved through searching and calling, occasionally they'd catch a glimpse of the moon through the trees, and it was similar in color to the glow of the craft, and that startled them. But, you know, the quiet woods in the dark and, you know, doing the searching, you know, took a lot of courage for what they were doing. But when they didn't, you know, find me after a while, Ken says that Mike, you know, fell to his knees and started crying. And Steve says bawling like a baby, but I'll tell you why he said that, you know, because they decided to go back to town. And they went in and they argued about what to do on the way back. And they said, we got to go get the authorities. And Alan Dallas says, no way, don't get the police, you know. He didn't want to, he's always been a black sheep, been in trouble with the law. And he said, we'll just go get some friends and get some guns. And then if we can't find him, then we'll go tell the sheriff. And then Ken says, well, you know, if we don't go tell him what happened and Travis never found, how's that going to look? We got to go. So, it was actually Ken who made the phone call, not Mike, and like in the movie. So Ken calls the sheriff, and the sheriff's deputy comes down, and you know, our coworker, he's missing, he might be dead, and oh, might be dead, huh? And then they start getting all suspicious. And so the deputy calls the sheriff, and he comes down with his second in command, and they start interviewing the guys, and right off the bat, they're suspecting that this is a cover story for a murder. You know, they figure one of the crew killed me, and the others were covering it up for some reason. So, but Steve was still crying, and some of the others were so shook up, you know, that the sheriff was certain that something real had happened, but he figured it was a murder. And that's what really got Steve so upset. When my first book came out and it described, you know, how he was one of the ones that was still crying, he got real mad. He came over to my house. He was going to fight, you know, because his cousins were teasing him about it. And you know, it's taken all this time for me to halfway convince him that there's no shame in that. He's a 17-year-old kid, and he just saw somebody get killed or thought he did. And so there was no shame in the fact that he was crying. So that's the reason he's emphasizing that Mike was crying. It's because he was crying too. So, you know, the sheriff, you know, unlike in the movie, they did go back that night, and he got half of the crew to go with him, and the other half took the truck back to the town. And the sheriff, second in command, he was an expert tracker, and they didn't find anything. The tracks went to the middle of the clearing, and that was it. But the real search began the next day. They got over 50 men on horseback and on four-wheel drive vehicles. They wound up including airplanes and helicopters, and they even brought tracking dogs out. And the dogs, you know, followed the trail up to the middle of the clearing, and that's where it ended. So during the search, the men were back at the clearing, which was kind of, you know, where the incident happened, but it was kind of the base for the search. They spread out, you know, each man within sight of the other, and made these great big sweeps through the forest looking for every sign. And the crew, the guys that were there, noticed that there was a guy dressed in a Forest Service uniform with a Geiger counter. And apparently these men were finding radiation. But when the crew went over there and said, "You find anything?" "Oh, no, nah, there's nothing here." So that's just background. See, 1.5 everywhere. And then he said, "Here's real radiation." And he held it up to this guy's radium dial watch, and he got a 3. And so he said, "Well, test us." So he tested the crew, and it was still 1.5. But Mike said, "Well, we've bathed and changed our clothes since then, but you know, we still got our hard hats in the truck." So they went back over to the truck and got the hard hats. And when he tested that, it went all the way up to 6, which was double that of the radium dial watch. But instead of testing further, the guy just gets this look on his face and just angrily rolls it up and stomps off. So that was kind of a strange situation. That was a, see, being Forest Service contractors, you know, Mike figured he knew all the local Forest Service guys, but he'd never seen that guy before. So whether he was really Forest Service or who sent him or what he really found, that was kind of a mystery. When I went back there winter before last with the National Geographic, they brought a Geiger counter. They were going to check for radiation. I was eager to retest it. Only when we get there do they say, "This isn't going to do any good because there's 2 feet of snow here and water blocks the radiation that we're looking for." So that's still something I'm going to follow up on this summer. That'll all be documented. But they were also standing at the clearing, and this Forest Service guy comes up to Dwayne Smith, grabs him by the shirt front and jerks him up close and says, "All right, where'd you hide the body?" And, you know, John Gillette explains that all the crew members that were present that were involved in the search, the sheriff put a deputy with each one of them, followed them around the whole day, just pushing at them, saying, "Come on, tell us what really happened. Who was it that, maybe it wasn't you, come on. Maybe Alan killed Travis, and you don't need to get yourself involved here. You know, you don't need to be covering for him. Tell us what really happened, and we can all go home here." But the men said, "No, that's not what happened." And so when this guy grabbed Dwayne Smith, my brother was also named Dwayne, says, "Hey, knock it off." You know, so the guy goes leaving. But the men said, "We'll take lie detector tests, sodium pentothal, anything you want. We're telling the truth." So the sheriff heard about that and arranged for the state police lie detector expert to come in and test the guys. So they were told to show up at the courthouse, which was actually also the jail. And so there was a lot of fear on the part of these guys that that this would be rigged, that the tests would be designed to prove that they had killed me, with a way that the sheriff had of calming the community and telling them, "It's okay, folks, nothing to see here, go on," you know, just to put closure on it. They killed him. They buried him. We'll never find the body. But when the testing was over and the examiner told the sheriff, "These boys are telling the truth," sheriff didn't really want to accept it, which is kind of ironic because had the lie detector man said, "Yep, Alan killed him. They all helped bury him," or whatever, no problem. They would have been sent to jail right then, no doubt about it. But if they saw a UFO, well, you know, something else happened here. It's really strange how, you know, even if 6 people saw somebody commit a murder and didn't take lie detector tests, that's a conviction right there, off to the electric chair. So kind of a uneven treatment of the evidence, and it's not just the sheriff. It's a lot of people ever since this happened. So when I was hit by that beam, I didn't see what happened. I just felt, I felt a kind of a burst of energy kind of a thing, but it was more like just a numbing shock, kind of like an electrical shock or a physical blow, and I blacked out. So when I flew through the air and hit the ground, I was all unconscious. When I woke up, it was all just pain, and I didn't just come to real quickly. I was in and out of consciousness for quite some time, and struggling to breathe. You know, I knew something was terribly, terribly wrong here. I didn't really know where I was at first. And then I remembered. I remembered approaching the object, and I figured something happened. I'd been hurt somehow, and that I'd been taken to the hospital. So I thought I was in a hospital. There was some, I knew I was on some kind of a raised gurney or operating table of some kind, because the ceiling was so close to me and there was this light above me. And it was only when I could finally focus my eyes that I saw these creatures standing over me. And then I knew for sure, you know, I was definitely not in a hospital, and I was in deep trouble. I just freaked out immediately. And even though I was so weak, I could hardly move, you know, I managed to move enough to push, or I tried to hit it away, but it was just more of a shove than anything. It was lighter than I expected, weak as I was, and it fell back into the other one. And I rolled away from it at the same time, and this thing that was across my chest fell off. But I was mainly just focused my attention on them. And I backed away and was screaming just hysterically, you know, get back, stay away from me. And they came around the table towards me. And as I backed up, I bumped into this shelf or a workbench or something behind me. And I just looked real quickly to just grab something to defend myself with. And there was all these instruments laid out there. But I just grabbed the biggest thing there that I could swing at them, which is not, it's cut off in the top of this picture, but I was holding up this long glass or plastic tube or rod and swinging it at them, you know, with a striking motion. They weren't close enough to hit, but they stopped short of that. And they all three stared at me there for a few seconds that seemed like forever. And those eyes just penetrated into me in the most disturbing kind of way. You know, it's just really hard to describe that the feeling that that gave me, this feeling of invasion, of something really, really, I definitely did not want something very threatening, you know. But I was thinking of how I was going to fight my way past them, because the only opening was this doorway behind them. And so before I could move towards them, they just suddenly turned and went out the door. And there was a little passageway out there, and they went to the right. So I went to the doors, and this was all very dimly lit, very cramped, very claustrophobic. And this diagram that I've got here is just what I pieced together later. I didn't know where I was. I was very disoriented and breathing, struggling to breathe. I just couldn't get enough air. And, you know, my loss of control and my out-of-control fear was just over the top. But I think it was more than just my situation. It was the fact that when I woke up, I was in a lot of pain. You know, the feeling that I knew I was mortally wounded, you know, very, very bad feeling inside. And but more than any of that is the feeling of suffocation. Waterboarding on terrorists is so effective that even though these people are trained that it's coming and you know, to expect it and how to resist it, it works anyway, because the feeling of suffocation works on a level beneath reasoning. You know, it's something beyond our control that is reaches a level of fear that is on the instinctive level. That you can't think it away, you can't reason it away. And so that, I think, was what, you know, caused this fear to erupt so out of control. And whether that feeling of suffocation came from the fact that the atmosphere wasn't right, or had something to do with the energy that hit me in the head and chest and caused some injury that way, it was something that just triggered fear that was just like nothing I've ever experienced in my life. And so I wasn't thinking clear. I was just had this idea that if I could just find a door, open it, I could just jump out and I'd be back in the woods where I was. But, you know, now knowing what I know now, it probably was not in the woods. And had I opened the door, you know, that would have been unlikely I could have ever managed to do such a thing, not understanding how things worked there. But, you know, it probably wouldn't have been a very good thing at all. But, you know, and looking for doors out in places where I was, it wouldn't have opened outward anyway. But like I said, I was just not thinking very clear at all. It was just total fight or flight kind of a situation. So I'm in this little tight, dimly lit passageway, and I'm thinking that these creatures might be behind me, but the curve was such a tight curve that I couldn't see very far behind me, and I couldn't see very far ahead of me. So I didn't know if they were catching up to me, and I didn't know if I was running into something worse. So it left me with this horrible feeling, you know, not knowing whether to run or not, but still running anyway. And I actually went past a doorway on my left before I got a little bit more of a control and came to the doorway on my right. I looked into this room, which at first just seemed to be pretty empty except for the chair in there. But when I moved into the room is when it would darken, and there were stars all around. But from the doorway, I could see rectangles around the walls that I thought would probably be doors. So I was trying to figure out a way to open those when I moved into the room, and it would darken with these points of light coming into view. And somehow the viewing this map or viewing screen of where it was at the time, whichever it was, could best be seen from the position of the chair, but not really very visible from any place near the walls or doors. But I moved over to the doors and tried to see if there was some kind of a button to open it or a doorknob or anything, but there was nothing. And I tried to look in the crack of the door, but I couldn't see any light or feel any air coming through there. So I went over to this chair, and I started pushing the buttons on the right arm, and none of those had any effect on the door. As a matter of fact, they didn't really seem to do anything. We didn't have touch screen in those days, so it never occurred to me to touch the screen to see if that did anything. But it was green, glowing green, and had these little black lines on it. With little segments on them. And some of the buttons would make those lines move and change angles. But there was no characters like numbers or letters. So none of that was opening a door. And so I decided to try the lever. And that caused all these stars to move at the same time. Not relative to each other, but the whole thing moved at once. And it gave me the sensation for a second there that everything was tipping. But it wasn't. As a matter of fact, I never felt any movement in the floor or anything at all. It was just a real disoriented feeling to have these points of light, which are kind of your reference for standing up, suddenly move. So I decided I better not mess with that anymore. And I was thinking of pushing another button, and something caught my attention. And from the door I'd come through, and I see this man standing there, and I immediately assumed that it was somebody there to rescue me. He looked like a human being, did not look like one of these little humanoids that I'd seen earlier. And so I just came towards him, you know, telling him about these creatures. You got to get me out of here. I was just babbling, really. And he didn't respond. But that didn't trouble me too much at the moment, because he was wearing this helmet, and I thought maybe he couldn't hear me with that on or couldn't speak with it on. So when he just wanted me to come with him and sort of took me by the arm, I was only too happy to go if we're getting out of here. He didn't seem to be scared like me, and that was very encouraging. And so we went out through what I take to be kind of an airlock thing. It was just this little passageway where one door closed and the other one opened. And then we came out into this brightly lit area. It seemed bright, really, to where it hurt my eyes. But it was a lot cooler and easier to breathe. And down this ramp, which really seemed much steeper than it ought to be, but I was pretty unstable on my feet, still not well balanced. And I tried to look around, but he was kind of rushing me along. But I know there was some other craft in there, disc-shaped, but more rounded and shinier. But I really had to pay attention just to keep from falling down, because he seemed to be in such a hurry. And this was a big room, a huge room, kind of like an airplane hangar. And the wall that we were walking towards was vertical, but the ceiling curved down to form another wall behind us. And that curved surface was these lighted panels that were giving off this light that was a lot like sunlight. So I don't know if these were like translucent windows where sunlight was just shining on them and coming through, or some sort of an artificial light source that was made to look like sunlight. But it was really bright and a lot fresher, and I felt a lot of relief coming out of there. But he took me out of this big hangar, like, I don't know whether it was part of a larger craft or a building somewhere, but there was some doors there. We went through down this hallway, and He left me with these other people, and he put me in this chair and then left. But they didn't have any helmets on. So, you know, I had enough, barely enough, brains left to think, well, you know, they're not wearing the helmets, they can answer my questions. So I started in with the same thing. Where am I? What are you guys doing with me? What are these creatures? You know, get me out of here. Where am I? You know, every kind of thing like that. But again, no answer. So now, because I knew they could hear me, you know, I'm starting to say, whoa, wait a minute, what's going on? Is this really a rescue or not?